Hi, Rocketeers. I'm your host, Karen Tongson, filling in for Guy Branum, who'd hoped to make it home for dinner, but things got topsy-turvy at the office. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wobbler. How you doing, Magwops?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, Karen?
Good. You have a very bright, springy shirt on with large polka dots of joy.
Marimekko.
Oh, yeah. People are really into that line.
That's good.
And we also have film critic and co-host of Max Fun's Who Shot Ya, also one of our honorary fifth Beatles, Alonzo Duralde.
Professor Tongson, nice to see you.
It's good to see you. Coming up on this week's show, in honor of the American series finale. We'll be talking about our enduring fascination with the Cold War and pop culture. Plus, we'll obviously be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Alonzo, since you haven't been here in a while, why don't you kick it off?
Okay. Well, this episode drops on June 6th, but this will apply really for the whole summer. Mm-hmm. June 6th is National Drive-In Day, paying homage to the fact the first drive-in in America was opened in Camden, New Jersey in 1933 on this very date.
Oh, wow.
And, drive-ins are this vintage great piece of Americana that has been dying away over the decades. You know, the real estate became too valuable or people didn't want to see movies outdoors anymore. But, you know, drive-ins are still great and they're still out there. And if you go to, I believe it's driveinmovie.com, yes, with no dashes or anything, it will tell you where the nearest one to you is. I personally, in Southern California, love to go to the Mission Tiki Drive-In. It's in Claremont.
Oh, okay.
It's about 45 minutes to an hour east of Los Angeles. But they have, you can tell they're taking care of the place. Like, there's no cracked asphalt, and there's these great big tiki statues, you know, and torches when you arrive, and their concession stand has great carne asada fries.
What?
Yes. And most drive-ins now, you don't get the speaker on the pole anymore. Like, you tune it into your radio so you can bring a boombox or, listen to it in your car or whatever. And, it's the perfect place to go see something like, I don't know, Action Point with Johnny Knoxville. That's a movie that was born to be viewed in a drive-in.
Yeah, half distracted with carne asada fries stuffed in your mouth. The drive-in that I used to go to with my family is still open, actually, in Riverside, California, Van Buren Drive-In. And one of the things that I did when I was a teenager is definitely cram people into the kind of hidden station wagon back section of my grandmother's Ford Escort.
Nice.
You know? And one of the things that made it tough, though, was if we were watching anything really kind of brooding, dark, or action related, the ambient lighting is pretty intense. So, Aliens was not a great film to see at the drive-in.
I remember seeing The Crow at the drive-in, and the sun hadn't quite set yet.
It's
a real dark movie. But, if you're seeing a Nancy Meyers film, you're fine.
But that's so goth at the beach. Do you know what I mean? You can't really get your full-on goth watching The Crow if the sun is still up.
Totally.
Well, we encourage you all to celebrate National Drive-In Day or
all summer long.
Yeah, do it. And, be bold enough to sneak someone in the car, but make sure they have enough air.
Yes. And, bring some booze, but don't tell anyone.
Yeah, just like any hang at the park. So.
Don't get caught, kids.
Don't get caught, kids. So, Magwops, what do you have for us this week?
I watched Ellie Wong's Hard Knock Wife, which is basically the follow-up comedy special that she has right now on Netflix. 2 years ago, she had Baby Cobra come out. And when she released Baby Cobra, or rather when she shot Baby Cobra, she was very, very pregnant, very adorably pregnant. It was basically this little basketball with sticks, her arms and legs attached, walking around the stage. And now she's pregnant again with number two. And just as she did the first time, there's just tons of frank, raunchy, honest, real talk about being a mother, about being a wife, about, her anger that there's not better maternity leave in this country, the kind of dark moments she has where she loves her baby girl, but she thinks about putting her in the garbage sometimes. it's so encouraging and enlivening as a new mom to see this person really embrace all the aspects of it, and to still be this like sexual raunchy person like that. I really appreciate that she still talks about her single days, but also like the sex she has with her husband, and just the sort of physical toll that giving birth can take on a body. She's hilarious, and she is a real treasure at this point. Like I feel like the show that she put together this time around just built on what she did with Baby Cobra and got even smarter and sharper.
It's a great special, and there is something wonderfully subversive about watching an exceedingly pregnant Asian woman just speak so frankly and forthrightly and filthily about sex. It's just a constant jaw drop, especially because I had not seen Baby Cobra. My main experience with Ali Wong up until now was American Housewife on ABC, which is very funny, and she's funny on it, but that's a Family Hour sitcom. And so this is sort of like those, you know, fans of Full House who stumbled upon Bob Saget's stand-up were like, oh my God, you know, this is a whole nother thing.
Yeah, it is interesting that like Bob Saget, though, couldn't be Dirty Bob Saget until later, like in the public eye. Like we couldn't hold Full House in our minds at the same time as Dirty Bob.
Okay, so before I get into my All About, which is also one of the things that we're going to be talking about, in an extended form this week, I'm going to give all of you the opportunity to shut your ears, fast forward, to leave the room, because I'm going to spoil the Americans ending for you, because I want to talk about it.
You're going to have to choose now.
You think we can trust him?
Yes.
Don't miss the final chapter of the Emmy award-winning series.
I'm going to kill him.
The Americans series finale.
So
this is my
cue
to exit for a temporary period of time, because I've only seen episode one, season one. Goodbye.
Okay. So we don't have Magwops involved in this conversation.
Tongson, I'm here for you.
Yes. I know that, Alonzo, you are deep into the Americans nerdistry as much as I. And so you've been, alerted. And now I really want to get into a little bit of the finale. Most of all, I really want to talk about the aspects of the finale that, people talking about the devastating separation between Philip and Elizabeth and, of course, their children, Paige and Henry. And I wanted to actually think a little bit more, apropos our topic, about how, sure, that's sad, but, the wall's going to fall in a couple years.
Right.
So, I think the linchpin of the finale is really its historical proximity to those events, and that this end of the series kind of looks onto the horizon of the end of the Cold War, and that it makes their ultimate sacrifice of giving up their children actually kind of tenable to some of us.
Yeah, it's sort of like, we get a lot of those dramas where, these things unfold, and then the kicker at the end is, and then World War II happened, and like everything got thrown asunder. And this is sort of the opposite, which is like, they're in the midst of the horrors of the Cold War and espionage and all this stuff, but we know more than they do that there is an end in sight, and that ending is going to mean that everything's up for grabs again. That, maybe they won't be able to waltz back into the United States as people who were spies and murderers.
We're not going to Falls Church anytime soon.
Exactly. But, there's going to be perestroika and glasnost and all that good stuff is going to happen. And there is the possibility that if Henry wants to see them, if Paige wants to see them, they probably could meet up in, Warsaw or something.
Yeah, somewhere in Europe. No extradition, that whole thing.
Yeah.
But also, I think that what it does is it provides a potential, it provides a sense of futurity for Philip and Elizabeth in a way that, where, so much of the buildup of the show was leading up to this sense of, I used the word earlier, finality. And we were assuming, and so many people were assuming, who's going to die? Who's going to, have to pay the ultimate price?
Who will get shot? That we had Chekhov's poison pill this season,
Yeah, absolutely. So, but it's, the Americans really stuck to its, nuanced approach to things, yes. And left that possibility. I actually wanted to share with you some speculation about what happens to Philip and Elizabeth after, in a couple years, mm-hmm. after the Berlin Wall falls, after Perestroika Glasnost succeeds. Masha Gessen, who I think wrote one of the better pieces about the Americans, and who also served as a translator for the show's Russian dialogue, which was really kind of amazing because her own knowledge of Russian was kind of frozen in Cold War Russian, is kind of when her own family left the country. So it was very period specific. And she wrote a little bit in The New Yorker about how she meticulously reproduced that version of Cold War Russian, but there have been new words since introduced. Mm. And that's relevant to Philip and Elizabeth and what might happen to them after 1989.
Das Laptop.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm going to read this quote from Masha Gessen. Quote, Philip and Elizabeth will be in demand. As KGB agents with excellent knowledge of English, they can get jobs at any number of new companies that are trying to both do business with foreigners and to stay out of the way of the secret police. They could also become biznesmeni and launch an enterprise of their own. Their connections and their English will be a great asset. Hell, they could build a travel empire because we know they were travel agents as part of their cover in D.C.
Yeah, they are completely armed for the new capitalist Russia because, once the gates to the West are open and people want to do business there, yeah, they speak perfect English. They've lived there for decades. They understand the American mindset. They understand capitalism. They understand all of that stuff. I'm sure by now they would be running one of the great bot farms, the ones that didn't have the clumsy sentences that could be obviously pegged as, clumsily translated from Russian or whatever. I think she totally nails it.
The question is whether or not, though, that any kind of reconciliation or rapprochement with their abandoned children would happen, right? Henry was always, as I said this on Twitter, we all knew he was kind of disposable, right? He was always going to get left.
Well, and the fact that I think the show was very shrewd about creating a really deep relationship between him and Stan.
Yeah.
And so I think in a way we didn't feel as bad about Henry being left behind because A, he had Stan, and in a way I think we felt better about Stan knowing that he had Henry to take care of after all this. I think part of why he doesn't shoot them in the garage is Henry. I think that's what's helped build that bond between him and this family, even after he finds out that his worst suspicions about this family are true.
And I know we're going to be talking a little bit more about the Americans, of course, in our main segment. But before, Margaret gets back in here and before people who are closing their ears for spoilers get back as well, I want to ask you whether or not you think Renee is or is not a KGB agent.
I don't know. And that's the most delicious part.
Right.
Because Stan will never know either, I don't think.
Yeah.
And he's got to live with that because I think he's not going to kick her to the curb and he's not going to, maybe he'll put her name in that computer the way he did with, Jennings, Elizabeth. Yeah. But I think ultimately he's just going to have to live with the mystery.
In many respects, it's the ultimate atonement for Nina and what happened to her.
That's true.
But also, I have to say, though, that I've been thinking a little bit about this and I know that the show's creators are like, no, we want it to be, something that the viewers decide on their own. Mm. My decision, actually, after rewatching the finale and all this, is that I think Renee is not.
Really?
Yeah. I think I've landed on the sense that she's not. She's just this kind of weird gal who likes to drive a Jeep and shoot guns and do shit like that. And that she really does kind of want more excitement and adventure and is happy with her office job at the FBI. But who knows? I think that her reaction, she's also played so beautifully. Her ambiguity is played so beautifully. But, the last scene we see Renee, and, after I saw that again, I was like, no, she's not a Russian spy. But who knows? You can debate us on our Twitter.
She could be a really good one, and that's why you didn't catch her.
It's true. Even after having spent 5 years with the Jenningses. Okay, so it's safe to listen again, but first we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to talk about the Cold War and more Americans after this.
Ha
I love it.
Good stuff.
Every time.
Well, I hope that you're enjoying this podcast you're listening to as much as we are pretending to. But anyway, why not listen to another podcast, too? It's called The Flophouse.
And on our podcast, we have recently watched a movie, often a bad movie, and we review it on our podcast, but mainly talk about other stuff and, I don't know, hang out.
It's all about hanging out, feeling like you're being with your best friends. Who are your best friends? Us three. Dan McCoy, Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show, Stuart Wellington, owner of the best bar in Brooklyn, Hinterlands, and Elliot Kalin, former Emmy-winning head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, former head writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, so many things. Author of the upcoming children's book,
All Right, that's enough.
The Elliot's credits just go on and on.
Yeah, but if you like the idea of listening to three funny guys talk about bad movies, then why not come over and listen to The Flophouse? It's available at MaximumFun.org or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So get out of here.
Welcome back to Pop Rock. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Margaret Wappler.
Alonzo Duraldi.
So we just talked about the Americans series finale, but we want to extend our conversation about this milestone show, one of my favorites of all time, certainly, but by talking about its context in the Cold War, fodder for decades of cloak and dagger, of double identities, of lots of crazy disguises, and also some interesting psychological drama as well. So we're going to be talking about all of these various ways in which the Cold War has managed to continue to keep a grip on our imaginaries, even though it ended nearly 20 years, officially, quote unquote, ended nearly 20 years ago. And I just sort of want to start by asking each of you to share any particular memories you had of when you were made aware of the fact that there was such a thing as the Cold War, that we had a, quote unquote, evil empire to contend with across the globe, whether or not you had any nuclear fallout drills at your school. What was the first thing that you recall alerting you to the way the world was divided?
I think for me, it was learning about the McCarthy hearings as a child. I think there was a thing on PBS called Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? And it was a play about the HUAC hearings. I think Liza Minnelli plays Lillian Hellman in that one.
Amazing.
But it was sort of the first time that I kind of figured out the whole thing about, like, the communists and the, you know, the good guys, basically. And
Don't call them capitalists.
Yeah, exactly, right. And the whole divide that was going on there. And then from there, it kind of spread outward of, like, oh, okay, we're aiming missiles at them, they're aiming missiles at us, and, you know, that's why we went to Vietnam. And, like, all the other little pieces of it kind of came together. But as a kid, I think, yeah, the HUAC was sort of my first attachment to a thing that implicated the division that was going on.
The Red Scare.
Exactly.
I think mine was more personal in the sense that I have some Russian heritage. And when I was in maybe fourth, fifth grade, and I just sort of through the osmosis learned that there was this thing called the Cold War and Russia was bad, Soviet Union was bad, Gorbachev was bad, I got a thrill out of telling my little classmates that I was Russian.
did they react in a way that made you feel like, you know, like I'm assuming that someone of, you know, who practices Islam now when they go to school gets completely...
It was like a bit of a controversial thing to say. I remember telling this friend of mine, like a really close friend of mine, about it and sort of almost thinking she would laugh or kind of like, whatever, just make a joke out of it. And she looked me dead in the eye and she was like, oh my God, you're a Russian spy. And she was like scared a little bit. And it was like something she would say to me when she was kind of angry at me.
that sense that you could, I think that one of the things that the Cold War gave us was the sense that anybody could be a spy, which obviously the Americans capitalized on. I mean,
yeah.
I have to say that, you know, being, you know, having come from a country in Southeast Asia, which was, you know, proximate to where the dominoes were falling. Mm-hmm. You know, the red peril as it was spreading through Southeast Asia, and where there were actual communist rebels and movements in the south of the country, in the Philippines, that's when I sort of became aware, oh, there's this thing that we should be afraid of. And it was only intensified when I came to the U.S., but it was the kind of geographical specificity of thinking about the Vietnamese or about North Korea or about China was shifted entirely into this Occidental context with, you know, Russia as the evil empire.
Yeah, and I do, because I grew up in Chicago, and Chicago is a kind of receiving city for a lot of Russians, a lot of Eastern European immigrants, always has been. I think it has something like the second biggest Polish population after Warsaw or something like that. At any rate, there was a few kids that came to school when I was in fourth, fifth grade that who were basically escapees from the Soviet Union. And that was also a way in which I learned about that conflict firsthand. And they were like, I mean, and looking back, I feel so bad for these kids. They had to sort of jump into this American school knowing barely any English, being sort of visibly, you know, like I remember this one kid wore the same sweatpants every day, and we were all kind of like, what's with him? You know what I mean? Like, they clearly didn't have a lot of the assets that the other American kids had. So that was like on one side, but then I think I watched a lot of Get Smart when I was a kid, on TV, and you know, Get Smart is an old TV show that was really running in like the late 60s, 70s, but then it was rerunning in the 80s, and it was a very thinly veiled spy versus spy kind of story with like a KGB like stand-in and the American CIA type stand-in. And it was, Maxwell Smart was the main agent and his much more capable co-agent, Agent 99, and the two of them would battle various KGB type spies.
There was also Boris and Natasha on Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
But I don't think I connected them, their Russianness, to the larger story being told. I mean, my sort of other childhood thing is that, you know, my parents both were born in Spain and were old enough to remember the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until I got older and started like learning more about it that wasn't necessarily just their memories of, you know, being hungry or whatever, that I realized, oh, this was sort of the dress rehearsal for the Cold War in a way, because you have on the one side this sort of like, you know, left leaning force that gets kind of more taken over by communist interests, and then you have, you know, this sort of center right that becomes more and more driven by, you know, German fascism. Yeah. And so those chess pieces play out there.
And it is, and that is part of also what I think has provided so much fodder for like TV, film, even music, is the notion of the world as a chessboard, right? The kind of chess pieces shifting around.
The musical chess.
Exactly. The musical chess is chest. Whoa.
Freudian
slip.
Your show.
Also, is about these Cold War themes. In fact, actually, you know, one of the things that the Americans capitalized on is how the 80s was such, I mean, in part because of, you know, Ronald Reagan. The 80s was such a kind of powerful locus classicus for many Cold War narratives, right? Because I think I feel like they really intensified in that period. Sure, you had, you know, your Cloak and Dagger movies of the 50s and 60s. You had Torn Curtain, the Hitchcock film with Julie Andrews and Paul Newman. You had musicals like Silk Stockings.
Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Yeah. And so, and you had, you know, From Russia with Love and James Bond. But the 80s felt particularly rife with kind of big and overblown narratives.
Rocky IV.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, so one of the things that Americans does really is it taps not only into this kind of Cold War interest, but our nostalgia for the 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, thinking back on that particular decade, what did we learn about Russia or what propaganda actually were we being fed as consumers of popular culture?
Yeah, I think it all got very cartoonish. Like pretty much that America fuck yeah number from Team America, like that's the 80s, you know, between Rocky IV and like the Frankie Goes to Hollywood Two Tribes video, you know, where Reagan and I forget which.
May have been Brezhnev.
Like literally wrestling in a pit. the narrative got very like, yeah, fuck you, man. We're going to nuke your ass, you know, sort of deal. And weirdly enough, it seems to have worked since, you know, it did bring us to the end of it. So maybe that was kind of like the literal last hurrah where you know, that sort of Reagan era brand of American obnoxious, like, you know, imperialism performance, you know, mm-hmm. sort of took us to that level.
And I think, you know, back then there was like this talk of World War III, like that was a real possibility. Like
it was it was a real possibility. It felt very, I had nightmares as a kid in the 80s.
There was a miniseries called World War III.
Yes.
After, was it after The Day After?
It may have been after. Did either of you see either of those films?
I watched The Day After.
The Day After or Threads, which was the British.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't see Threads.
These nuclear annihilation movies.
I watched The Day After the night it aired. Yeah. I was, I think, in 9th or 10th grade, and that freaked me out.
What's going on?
Those are Minuteman missiles.
Like a test, sort of. Like a warning?
They're on their way to Russia. They take about 30 minutes to reach their target.
So do theirs, right?
I think as children in the 80s, I feel like we were very much exposed to...
Testament, remember that one?
Yeah, to like these doomsday scenarios where, like, you know, your skin is peeling off. And even the music of the era, too, had that kind of intensity to it, you know.
Yeah.
99 Red Balloons, 99 Luftballons is all about, you know, like the
accidental launching.
Yeah, and I feel like radio was sprinkled with German words and pops, like 99 Luftballons. Like, I can't imagine a German crossover song like that now, like of that political nature, where she's basically talking about, like, you know, mistaking one of these balloons for an actual weapon of war. And I just, that doesn't happen anymore. And in a way, I feel like our music is stripped. I mean, if we were to say there's some, you know, like an always brewing conflict now with, like, the Middle East or Islam, you know, at least by like Trump standards, like we don't hear those kinds of words salted in, like jihad or whatever. Like, I feel like that got stripped away from music. Like, everyone wanted to back off from that.
And I can't help feeling that part of what has driven our politics toward the Middle East is the vacuum of the Cold War ending.
Oh, absolutely.
That so much of our politics and our economy and our sort of national mentality relies upon this...
The big bad Russians.
...source of terror, yeah. And so, like, we lost the Soviets, so now it's got to be the mullahs or whatever.
Yeah, well, there's no distinct and clear evil empire.
It's true.
So you have to demonize an entire culture and religion of people, which isn't sticking as much.
No.
One of the things that we never saw represented in the Americans, of course, is the kind of absolute jingoistic thread of those 80s films, often starring Sylvester Stallone, whether or not Russia's the enemy, like Rocky IV, or, you know, the Rambo films, which also, you know, Vietnam, we don't often centralize as much in our discussions of the Cold War. We think of it as a separate entity, but it's certainly part of that. All of those Vietnam War films in the 80s, all of the kind of parodic versions of that, or like what we think of as the kind of extended Rambo series.
Right, all those canon movies with Chuck Norris or, you know, you know, American assassin or whatever, you know. It's funny because actually Chuck Norris made a movie called Invasion USA, which is a classic sort of
Red Dawn type.
Yeah, classic Red Scare, like the Russians are going to come take the malls away. And then interestingly enough, there's an old movie called Invasion USA. They did on Mystery Science Theater, but the premise of the film is basically it's a bunch of people in a bar, and they're all very sort of. It's clearly like they've lost their World War II fervor as far as, like, you know, production of, you know, a strong military and, you know, volunteering for the army and, you know, doing all this stuff that kind of builds a nation. And so this guy hypnotizes them into thinking that the nukes are dropping and that the Russians are invading. And it basically scares them all into realizing they've got to mobilize and they've got to get back on track. And, you know, we need to, like, basically return to a wartime economy, even if we aren't technically at war, because, you know, the Russians are pounding at our door.
Yeah, I mean, and now, of course, you know, one of the things that people have discussed as part of, like, what made especially later seasons of The Americans compelling is our different relationship to Russia, right? And the kind of current history and the kind of it's Russia's interference in our presidential election
for
and the kind
of like, alleged
interference. Putin as a, you know, former KGB strongman. And, you know, it's sort of, oh, Russia is back in our collective consciousness again as this kind of shady, shadowy figure. And, you know, it's interesting because there is a knockoff of the Americans in Russia. Have you guys heard about this show?
No.
It's actually Jay McInnes, Rocketeer on Twitter.
Hey, Jay.
Shared an Atlantic story about this TV series called Sleepers. It airs on Russian television, and it basically features, in the contemporary moment, CIA agents running amok in Moscow, causing like bad things to happen. And that, in fact, they're like the creators of that show, one of them is like a strong Putin supporter. Some of them have like their hands in like his, or have even participated in his propaganda machine. So there's a way in which the formula that was presented to us about the Americans, in the Americans, about these Russians infiltrating everyday life in America has now become a thing used in contemporary Russian propaganda.
That makes sense to me that there's that show in Russia. I think that's a real American-Russian relationship. Like, there's a very like tit for tat kind of.
I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah, like it, like everything that we say, everything we accuse them of, they would return and they would accuse us of in return.
And I remember we're both right.
Yeah, I remember interviewing Nadia from Pussy Riot, and you know, one of the things she said was just like every single aspect of the kind of accusations that we would lay at Putin's feet. She was like, you could say the same thing about your American administration, you know, anything from like warmongering to tampering elections, you know, it's just, you know, what we think happened in Ukraine, you know, things like that. So it's just, I think that makes perfect sense to me that's happening.
I know. I wonder maybe that's what ends up happening to Philip and Elizabeth, is that eventually they become consultants on the Sleepers.
Well, that's what happens to everyone when you leave your industry, become a consultant.
Well, I mean, you know, as we've been talking about, though, you know, the Cold War has been ostensibly over for about 20 years, but there's been a surge, actually, I think, in popular representation of it in movies like Atomic Blonde. There was a period where it was happening, particularly like kind of in that, you know, post-fall of the Berlin Wall context, because the Berlin Wall is such an iconic aspect, obviously, of the Third World War, of the Cold War. And, you know, we had, for example, films like the kind of looked on the other side, like Goodbye Lenin, which takes place at the end of the Cold War. And it's essentially a young man has to convince his mother that the Cold War hasn't ended. Because it would traumatize her. She's just come out of a coma. We also have The Lives of Others, a Stasi agent, who, you know, we get a glimpse at, you know, his increasing intimacy with subjects.
Well, one thing I really like about Goodbye Lenin is that it calls to mind the issue that just because the wall got torn down and that regime ended, which was good and fine and everyone agrees should have happened, doesn't mean that the ensuing onslaught of capitalism was a good thing to have happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think a really great moment in that movie is like, you know, the son is trying very hard to maintain this complete fictional reality that mom is still living in the GDR.
Yeah.
And she sees out the window this giant red blazoning Coca-Cola sign. And she's like, what's that? And, you know, he has to come up with some kind of excuse. And you know, it's interesting in the movie too, because she's a great believer in the regime. He wasn't. He was
a young person.
Yeah, young person, you know. And was actually like protesting it. And she saw that. And that's like why she had her heart attack. So, you know, he in representing or reenacting East Berlin actually starts to respect certain things about it. And the movie is interesting in just creating this kind of domestic sphere where, mm-hmm. like, you know, never mind the sort of broader geopolitical ramifications of what the GDR meant, just that, like, these are people that just got used to eating this type of pickle.
He's got to find the same pickles. He's got to find the right label.
The crappy, like, East German Coca-Cola equivalent, you know. It's funny, one of my favorite, remember the Sprockets sketches on SNL?
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite ones was right after the wall came down, the Dieter is excited, is so excited that, like, his favorite East German filmmaker is going to come on because his work is really dark and difficult, and they bring him out, and it's Woody Harrelson, and he's wearing, like, a Hawaiian shirt and one of those hats with the beer cans in it with the two straws, and he's like, woo! You know, just the idea that this guy who had been, like, the super serious dark artist in East Germany, the second the wall comes down, becomes, like, this sort of ugly American capitalist.
Everyone's tilted away Hasselhoff after that.
Yes.
Well, yeah, and don't you feel like everyone wanted to see Berlin, like, after the wall fell to sort of get a sense of what it was like then? And, like, Cuba still, you know, too.
Sure.
Like, we don't want to see Cuba become like us. We want to see Cuba as it was in a communist state, just at least on a purely, like, aesthetics and curiosity kind of level.
I went to East Berlin in 1996, and so the wall had been down for about six or seven years at that point. And there were still buildings where on the outside they looked really grim and brutal or whatever.
Yeah.
But you would walk in and the inside was completely, you know, contemporary and colorful. In fact, it was in a building like that that I got to see one of the great repertory theater experiences of my life. I saw Billy Wilder's 1, 2, 3 in East Berlin, which is a movie that's all about the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
So even though it was dubbed in German, I couldn't really follow it. I'd already seen it before, so I knew what happened. But it was just a perfect kind of, like, time and place movie to see this thing. But on the other hand, driving into East Berlin, like, past where the Brandenburg Gate used to be, like, on the left, there's a Fridays.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what stands at Checkpoint Charlie now, American sector? There's a KFC and a McDonald's right there. next to the Der Mauer Museum, right? It's like, KFC, hey, cool. Come hang with a colonel. Not a Cold War colonel, but everybody's colonel.
A Civil War colonel.
But it's interesting, you know, that Goodbye Lenin, films like that, and the Lives of Others are part of this thing that people called nostalgie or nostalgia for the East. And it's interesting the ways that the Americans actually try to play with that with its own characters, because obviously they could never speak Russian. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, you know, express any interest in anything having to do with Russia, including the food. But there are scenes and there are moments, obviously, where, you know, Paige is learning about Tchaikovsky or where towards the end where Philip rents the garage right? And you know, like, it's a bold move to rent this, you know, Russian series and why, you know, from your local video store.
I think that maybe that this part of our nostalgia for that period is that the Cold War feels in the way that I think, you know, World War II in a long distance seems like, you know, the good war and the easy war to pick sides on. The Cold War has kind of become an easy thing to remember in terms of, like, how bad the Soviets were and how good we allegedly were, because it's a pre-9/11 conflict.
Yeah.
And I think after 9/11 is where things get muddier and we start questioning our side and our motives and all that kind of thing. Whereas before, even though we can say, yes, you know, Reagan was too much with the saber rattling or whatever else, there is something almost sort of comfortingly, you know, black and white about the Cold War that we don't get in our current bugaboos.
Although shows like The Americans, and particularly what The Americans accomplished, is to create this kind of universe of nuance.
Sure, in the gray areas.
And you know, and in fact, like, there were certainly, obviously, as you're pulling for these Russian spies, you see how the tiniest shifts in policy, the kind of efforts to, you know, prevent something like a total nuclear arsenal buildup or even biological warfare is, you know, there's more to that.
And there's people like that general that Elizabeth murders, you know, like, clearly there were people on our side who were like, I'm going to reach out and try and find the moderate on the other side to prevent what the worst elements on either side are trying to cook up.
Well, I think there is something too about the Cold War being all all bark, no bite for Americans. You know what I mean? Like, it was all threat and it was all paranoia. And is this going to happen? And are we going to all blow up? But then nothing really happened on our side.
There were no battlefields.
No, there was no battlefields. And I feel like The Lives of Others touches on that interesting sense that when there is a threat looming, it can be invigorating for artists. And I think that happened in the 80s for musicians, for instance. It kind of gave this, like, this chilly edge to so much music.
All that new wave.
Yeah, all that new wave, all those, like, angular chords and all of that kind of stuff.
Laurie Anderson.
Yes, really benefit. Yeah, absolutely, Laurie Anderson really benefited from this sense that, like, we were all going to just die in this nuclear fallout. But, I mean, I thought that The Lives of Others, I just saw it, so it's very fresh in my head. There's this moment towards the end. This isn't exactly spoiling anything, but, like, the one of the former Stasi officers says to a playwright, you know, after the wall has fallen, you haven't written anything since the wall has fallen. What's going on? Wasn't it better back then? Didn't you feel like you had something to rail against? Didn't you feel like there was a side or somebody to fight against? And now there's nothing. Now we're just like Europe, you know, it's fine. It's democracy. And I thought that was a really interesting point to make that in a sense, like when we have this concrete enemy, which we don't right now, right? It's like much more foggier and shakier and murky.
I mean, we have the president.
That's true. That's true.
I remember working at the Advocate, and at the, when Bush v. Gore was finally over, and it was, you know, that election was finally resolved by the Supreme Court, there was this moment of silence, and our publisher Judy Weider just said, "Well, it'll be good for art."
that's always the, like, haggard response to when something really
some horrible thing
happens.
Yeah.
Well, what do we think, though, of something then, like, fairly recently, like Atomic Blonde, that tries to recapture some of that excitement? I mean, I have my own thoughts about this film, but...
I mean, I
people went crazy for it.
Did they? I don't know what... I want to hear from these people that went crazy, because I miss what the appeal is. I watched, like, maybe 30 minutes of it, and it just seemed like a really stylish music video to me, which is fine, but it just didn't have a lot of gravitas and meat to it. It was... To me, it was almost actually a grand commentary on how safe this conflict is to talk about and repackage as something totally stylish that doesn't really have much teeth or fang at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably had a... I mean, there are things about Atomic Bomb that I like that don't necessarily have anything to do with the Cold War aspect of it, but for that, for the kind of movie that's hopping back and forth between sides of the Iron Curtain, I think I probably had a better time at the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie.
I was really curious about that one.
It was fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Atomic Blonde. I really wanted to like it. I dove into it, but it felt to me, as I mentioned to both of you over email, that, you know, like the bouillon cube of everything Cold War, insofar as all of the subtle notes and flavors are completely sucked out of it. And what you get is this, like, intense crystallization of all of the salty
highlights.
Notes, you know,
and none of the, like, subtlety.
And it's like nonstop, like, it's like every 80s hit with any vague association.
Right. Get that Flock of Seagulls in there. Get that Derek Commissar in there.
You have your, what's his name? Thomas, what's his face?
Dolby.
Major Tom.
Tom Schilling.
And which I happen to know in its original German. I mean, that was actually one of the things, too, where, like...
Can you go ahead and just recite that?
Völlig losgelos zu dem Erde. Okay, yeah. So, you know, that was one of the things, too. Like, I have this curiosity.
I was like, after the fires, Der Kommissar better than Falco's, but that's just me.
Oh, yeah, it is better. Come on.
So, several of our listeners on Twitter... wanted to make sure that we at least touched upon the Hunt for Red October. Stephanie at Ivan's sister on Twitter said, The Hunt for Red October is a movie I can watch again and again. Other people directed us to the special episode of The Greatest Generation, also on The Hunt for Red October. So that seems to be one of these popular Cold War holdovers. Anybody have any feelings or thoughts about that? Or do you have films that you think might be better candidates?
I kind of like Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World is a movie that is It came out in the 80s or the early 90s. It's set in 1999 and presupposes that there is still a Soviet Union. So that's kind of an interesting oopsie. If you can find the five-hour version, that's the one you want to go with. It's much better than the American cut.
You are really married to Dave White, aren't you?
It's true.
I think, you know, Wim Wenders for me too is an early sight of Berlin. I always think about Wings of Desire, you know, from 1987, where at that point, like, seeing glimpses of Berlin was a rare, rare thing in a movie.
It seemed so exciting. Also because, you know, Berlin, the entire city was in East Germany, but the city itself was divided in half. So it was a kind of strange thing. It's like this little island in the middle of
There's a funny gag in the original 1967 Casino Royale where they're crossing from West to East Berlin, and West Berlin is all this sort of garish neon, and there's like a nightclub called Der Sexy Blau Angel Striptease. And then as soon as they get across the wall, it's like all gray and grim and balalaika music. You know?
Well, that was always the thought. But I mean, but it's so funny that many of the fashionable neighborhoods that exist in Berlin now are in the East.
Oh, yeah. Yes, right? Like all of them, pretty much.
It's the Brooklyn of Berlin.
It's certain, may I ask you if you have any favorite defectors from the period of the Cold War? Celebrity defectors, athletes, people like Mikhail Baryshnikov who defected to the
US? I mean, Baryshnikov's sort of the obvious answer. I'll go with Alexander Gudinov, just because he's so good in Die Hard. Yeah. And he was Jackie Bissett's boyfriend for a long time. But another great ballet dancer. And I guess the big troika, it's him, Misha, and Rudolf Nureyev, right?
Yeah, all of the Soviet ballet stars defected. Yeah. I, of course, have to go for some favorite female athletes. Martina Navratilova
being one of them.
The story of her defection looms very large in her autobiography. And of course also Nadia Comăneci, the great gymnast
from Romania.
From Romania. So they weren't Russian, they're from the Eastern Bloc, but we certainly got our share of Eastern Bloc.
Olga Korbut stayed, though, right?
I believe she did.
Okay.
How about you, Margaret? Can you think of any defectors?
I can't think of any defectors, but I just wanted to mention remembering how many heavy metal acts played in the Soviet Union, which I always thought was a very bizarre twist. Like, how did that end up happening? But it was like Pantera, Ozzy Osbourne, Def Leppard. Like, name any of those hair metal bands, and they played in Moscow or someplace
I guess the Voice of America, were they big on? I'm thinking of Hedwig. How else were they hearing these bands?
Don't know. There's also something great that you can find on the internet, which is a list of banned Western acts, music acts, that they wouldn't play in Russia no matter how popular. And then there's reasons cited next to the acts, and Donna Summer, it's just eroticism.
And they weren't wrong.
But she became real Christian afterwards. LA County Fair performance was tinged with a lot of Christianity.
I do say, but before we, going back to the wall real quick, Hedwig and the Angry Inch is definitely one of the great sort of Berlin Wall metaphors.
Yes,
movies.
Of course.
We can't leave that one out.
We definitely can't leave that one out. Speaking, I guess, sort of about music. So Sophie Oberfield and I kind of got into it on Twitter a little bit because she's a real big fan of Billy Joel.
Another early Soviet.
Yeah, Leningrad.
That's right.
Yeah.
But also, she made a pitch for Weed and Start the Fire. Do you have any particular tunes or music videos that you remember really? Already mentioned Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I'll just say about Weed and Start the Fire that my eighth grade history teacher made us study each and every lyric.
Wow.
Which has always stayed in my mind as another reason to hate that song. I also just don't. I don't like songs that just shout out a bunch of things.
Leonid Brezhnev.
But you got. We also got Land
That's
of Confusion.
The end of the world,
Do you guys remember the Land of Confusion?
Oh, Genesis, right?
From Phil Collins.
It was Genesis. Phil Collins or Genesis.
I think it was just Phil at that point.
Did they have the puppets?
They had the puppets.
The spitting
the
image
puppets. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the Donald Fagen New Frontier video, which is all about trying to seduce a woman in a bomb shelter in the 1950s.
Wow.
And that sort of leads to that Atomic Cafe era of wasn't this hilarious how we thought we were going to survive one of these things, and duck and cover became an object of camp.
Yes.
Well, I know. I mean, you know, bunker stylings.
Well, it's interesting that, like, Games Without Frontiers, the Peter Gabriel song, has become such a commonly used song in, like, every TV show, every, like, movie trailer you've ever seen.
Peter Gabriel was really huge to the Americans as a series as well. There were whole articles written about the kind of strategic use of Peter Gabriel in that show. I mean, also, I feel like the music supervision was really canny because it didn't, I mean, it,
I noticed that just it had
its it had its share of like the big hits, but it, you know, and I've shared some of the songs, of course, that have cropped up that are like deep cuts from Tears for Fears from their like first album before Songs from the Big Chair, or, you know, what was the thing?
The episode where the young, where the teenage girl plays Philip Yaz.
Oh, yeah, like plays Yaz on the boombox while
adorable.
He's on assignment. It's like, it's so dear. Anyway, I mean, obviously, I keep trying to veer us back to the Americans, but, you know, well, anyway, I know that you'd like us all to speculate more about the future of various characters in the Americans, but since we'd already kicked Margaret out, Nick White, I'm looking at you. I answered your question on Twitter. We can't kick her out again.
I mean, you
to
could.
Go into
I went and drank
what
Sabina
happens
Verde.
With
I was
all
okay.
these folks on the Americans. But, you know, we have a thread on our Facebook page. You've got us on Twitter. Share with us your favorite hot Cold War tips and faves. And in the meantime, since we were talking about music, we're going to break now before we get into our weekly jams.
In a world dominated by dude bro movie podcasts, a world where Casey Affleck has an Oscar and Angela Bassett does not, only one podcast is brave enough to call bullshit. Who Shot Ya? With Ricky Carmona.
A lot of people don't know Porgs, Puerto Rican.
Alonzo Duralde.
I would eat Oakjaw.
April Wolf.
I want to interrupt and say that the fish man was real sexy.
Drea Clark.
I have a real soft spot for King Kong.
And women of color.
I was like, damn!
Ryan Coogler got final cut.
Coogler got final cut?
I just felt like the film was so sour and so completely irrelevant to basically anything in life.
Who Shot Ya? Listen every Friday on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm Karen Thompson. With me in the studio,
Margaret Wappler.
Alonzo Duraldi.
So every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? And I have a feeling we're going to get some good jams this week. Hot Cold War jam.
Well, we had an unprecedented event, we should tell the listeners, and that we all had jams picked, and then we all just changed them, much to the dismay of our producer, Laura Swisher. But she's hanging tight. Well, I was almost not going to play this song because lately Morrissey has been kind of an ass, as you guys all know. Yeah, so I wasn't going to play it, but then the pull of this song is too deep. I love this song from the Smiths.
It's as much
ass.
About Johnny Marr, too.
And it's so much about Johnny Marr, because like the guitar work in this is magical. But this is Ask. This is one of many, many songs, I feel like, from this period of time. You know, came out in 86, that the word bomb just gets sprinkled in it, because it just had an impact back then that it just doesn't quite have now. But anyway, this is Ask. And this is one of the greatest songs in the Smiths catalog.
Luxembourg, ask me, ask me, ask me. Ask me, ask me, ask me. Because if it's not love, then it's the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb that will bring us together.
Yeah, give me some seagulls, you know?
There's
just
so many seagull sounds,
in there.
Ambient seagull sounds in 80s music.
Yes.
Language, can't you read?
I just want to say this is such a dear song to me that I maybe have about three songs that appear in my novel Neon Green, and this is one of them.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Alonzo, what appears in your novel?
It's funny that during that period of the late Cold War in the 1980s, it was so permeative that you didn't have to say Russia. We were all just sort of thinking about Russia all the time. So you could just sort of make a vague reference towards something Russian-ish, and we knew what you meant. For example, from the Police's final album, Synchronicity, Miss Grudenko. Don't tell the director I said so. But are you safe, Miss Grudenko? We were at a policy meeting. They were planning new ways of cheating. I didn't want to rock your boat, but you sent this dangerous note. So much spy intrigue in this song.
I feel like I wish the Americans had used Miss Grudenko in one of the many scenes of espionage involving, you know, sitting around.
Drops, yeah, or the male
robots.
It's like
two on the nose for them. Or
maybe
like,
a little.
Oh, go
yeah,
deeper.
It's like when they did This Woman's Work on Handmaid's Tale. It's like, okay, slow your
roll. I don't get it.
Speaking of on the nose, it's a very tantric sting kind of evening here in the booth because my jam... at least my first jam of the day, is Sting's very much on the nose. And this is, of course, in honor of Philip and Elizabeth. It's called Russians. You're a bomb of America. There's a growing feeling of hysteria. Conditioned to respond to all the threats. Speeches of the Soviets. Mr. Khrushchev said he will bury you. I don't subscribe to this point of view. It would be such an ignorant thing to do if the Russians love their children too. We know the Russians love their children too. They might just not always take them everywhere. Anyway.
But they'll send them to boarding school.
I feel like a little embarrassed for Sting listening to that song.
Aren't you? And it was such a huge hit, actually. Don't you feel embarrassed?
It's under the nose. Like, it's not even on it.
Well, the song that we all really wanted to play for you is a song that we're going to go out with today. And it's Jesus Jones right here, right now. Watching
none
the
of us had the cojones to play this
as
our
individual song.
Admit it.
So we collectively, in the communist spirit, present it to you as our parting offering. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Karen Tongson, with Margaret Wappler and Alonzo Giralde. Alonzo, tell us about the many places people can find you.
Oh, golly. Days. I co-host the Linoleum Knife podcast. I co-host Who Shot Ya here on Maximum Fun. I co-host What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. And if you are a subscriber to Filmstruck, look for me this month. I'm involved in the Dressing the Part drag documentary. And also, I'm introducing a whole bunch of Derek Jarman movies. And Derek Jarman directed the Ask video.
Oh, shit.
So it all ties together.
Such a perfect pretty bow.
And we should tell people that actually I've been quietly and discreetly killing a Russian spy for half of the show. You guys didn't know.
With her high heels.
Yeah, I've got to work on getting them into the suitcase later. So our theme music usually is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Right now we've got, Jesus Jones. But thanks to Ozzy Mizo for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Sure, Margaret may be happy in her, like, Uniqlo brightly colored shirt today, but who knows? That pallor may come back. So please review us.
Never had a pallor. Thank you very much.
This week, we'd like to thank Shash Kebab. Love that name. Shash Kebab says, this podcast is how I stay abreast of pop culture these days, since I don't have time to read things anymore. Join the club. Also, I'm here for Guy Branum's deep Judaica jokes. Kunzi says, this is my favorite pop culture podcast. Thank you, Kunzi. It has the best panel of fun, smart people, and it superbly curates its guest panelists.
Thank you.
Superbly curated, Alonzo. Recent highlights include Guy calling out A Quiet Place for being 100% white, Margaret recommending Japanese pop girl group Perfume, and me learning that April Wolf exists in the world.
Solid points.
So get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and be a part of the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Julian Burrell. Our producer is not the cold or at war, Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
Waited, waited. I was alive and I waited for this.
Right here, right now. There is no other place I want to be.
I feel like Philip could totally square dance to this song.
Line dance.
Oh, line dance. That's what he was doing, guys.